Thank you, the Hart Tong Chair of the Education Subcommittee Ways and Means, and Senator Trow and Representative Hobson, LFO staff. My name is Peter Courtney, and I'm a state senator from here in the Salem Kaiser. They call it Senate District 17. And you and I, Mr. Chair, are familiar with the issue that I bring before you and in the interim, and that is that I introduced a bill, actually had it introduced as a committee bill, and it should be before you, SB 38, which would limit the size of our public schools to around 400 for elementary schools and 500 for the middle schools and 800 for the high schools. And this kind of concept is somewhat dramatic when people first hear about it, because all of my days in the legislature, when we got on schools, when it comes to size, that have been on class size, we have not really done a lot on school size. And in a society which we believe bigger is better, which is truly what we do, we constantly believe is bigger is better, these bills go the other direction. We know that states with larger schools and school districts have the worst achievement in social outcomes. This has all been identified through research that's been going on in this country for at least the last 15 years. And the students who would best benefit from small schools are economically disadvantaged, and minority students are, particularly those who are economically disadvantaged, and minority students would particularly benefit with smaller schools. Yet these are the schools, students who are primarily concentrated in large schools within our school district. And that's a generic statement. But if you think about in Oregon alone, if you wanted to look at those economically disadvantaged as well as students of color, you will find that more than often than not, they're in your bigger schools. But that's not the only group of students. I'm talking about all students when I talk about schools should be smaller. Although literature supports educating children in small schools, the consolidation trend continues to create large schools. And I would just like to say that this phenomenon started after the Second World War when I was a little baby, and that the number of schools in the U.S. has declined 70%, while the average school size has grown fivefold. This was a phenomenon that we decided as a society, a conscious choice we made after the Second World War, that bigger was better when it came to educating our kids. And it was only until 10 years, or 15 years ago, that some of the best researchers, and the outline of my testimony, I don't want to go through all that in terms of reading my testimony, started to study just school size alone. From 1940 to 1990, the average enrollment in public schools grew from 127 to 653 students. Today, 71% of all high school students go to facilities with an enrollment higher than 1,000. In the state of Oregon, it's interesting, and I will get to this later, I have on a single sheet of paper, which I think is before you, the 4A, 3A, 2A, and 1A schools in the state of Oregon. And if you get to that, that's just high schools, not even talking about elementary and middle schools. If you get to that sheet of paper, you'll know something's dramatic. You'll see that overwhelmingly the number of high schools that are under 800, there's a many more number of those. But then if you look at the 4A high schools in the state of Oregon, I think there's 78 of them, and look at the total number of students there versus all the 3A, all the students in the 3A, 2A, 1A, and I'm just taking high schools, you'll see that far and away the vast majority of Oregon's kids in high school, where our dropout rate is 25%, one of the highest in the nation, are in those big mega high schools. And some of them are mega high schools. Right here in Salem, five 4A high schools, the second biggest in the states here, all five of my 4A high schools in Salem-Kaiser are in the top seven in the state. The biggest is Westview. And then you get the Beaverton, you get the South, you get the Sprague is a horrendous. Sprague is 2,200. And I'm getting carried away here because I also have the biggest middle school in the state in my district. It's been the biggest. When my wife taught, it was then junior high school in Whitaker. She taught, coached there for 10 years. Whitaker today is still the biggest. It was then junior high school, now middle school, with over 1,200 to 1,300 kids in it. Remember, that was supposed to, that they say that middle schools should be more bigger than 500. High school is no bigger than 800. When's the last time you've heard of any 4A high school with 800 students in it or less? There are a few. I'll name them for you. You know it's coming. Central Catholic, St. Mary's, i.e., the parochial schools. Even Jesuits blown through the 800. There are 1,000, and they're desperately trying to hold that. I'm getting carried away, but I just thought I should personalize some of this. Now, the benefits of small schools, I'm just going to say straight out. Small schools promote more positive personal and academic attitudes. Studies indicate that large schools appear to promote negative teacher perceptions of school administration and low staff morale. This I did not understand until I talked to some principals in smaller schools. There doesn't seem to be as much fighting going on between the teachers and the administration in the smaller schools. And in the bigger schools, it isn't so much the fighting, but it's them and us. There doesn't seem to be the same getting together. Now, I hadn't thought of that because I was thinking about student achievement. But even in students, I mean, in teachers working with the administration, I found overwhelmingly the small school makes a difference that it's we're all in this together. We're in this together. We're part of a team. We're part of a family. I don't think it's hard to figure out why that is, Mr. Chair, when you think of your own life. If numbers are so big, you know, you don't remember people. You don't know people. They don't know you. And when you do get together with them, you don't have much time simply because of the magnitude of numbers and all those different entities in your life. You know, that is one of the reasons. Now, when teachers are removed from their principal by several layers of administration, they are frustrated in their attempts to make their school better. An important benefit of smaller schools is the closer connection students have with adults, making them less likely to fall through the cracks. Research has found a strong negative relationship linking students' achievement accomplishments in school size. The larger the school, the lower the student's achievement. I want to go on. Extracurricular perceptions, participation. There are others. Students participate in extracurricular activities at significantly higher levels in small schools than in larger ones. Students in smaller schools participate in a wider variety of activities and hold important positions within the activity. Let me tell you right here and now, if you go to a 4A high school, unless the almighties, the gods of gods, have given you a DNA and a gene pool that's unbelievable, you're going to play one sport, if anything, in those 4A high schools. If nothing else, the coaches are going to see to it you play one sport. The games they play with kids, you will not believe. You think the, you know, soccer season's over? You better end up going into indoor soccer, and you better play spring soccer and summer soccer. If you don't, when you come out again in the next fall, basketball, volleyball, they're all the same. Football is different. It's the one sport that has tremendous numbers. You can get hurt, but it doesn't force you into the year round. Even baseball, we've gotten into fall ball, into baseball. So, whereas in the smaller high schools, I mean this, the teachers, they almost encourage the kids to play a multiple number of sports or other activities. Plus, kids are always inclined to get cut. I mean, it's just as simple as that. So, kids are involved in a greater variety of extracurricular activities, not just sports, but extracurricular activities in general, when you have smaller schools. So, the teachers do better, administration does better, the students in extracurricular activities do better. The academic achievements, it's all been documented, are higher. The dropout rates is much lower, and the discipline problems are dramatically lower. I am summarizing now rather than reading all the stuff I put in front of you. The Columbine High School situation we get into, all the violence in schools, if you see in most of the high schools, have come out of mega high schools. I am not saying, because sure enough, if I do, within 24 hours of statement I make here, we'll have a horrible act of violence in some small school. But I'll tell you, all the experts will tell you, the size of the schools, once they get so big, it scares them more in terms of a kid feeling like they're a nobody. If Vern Duncan was sitting here today, you'd make the statement he made before you, Mr. Chair, in the interim. When he was superintendent of instruction, there were days that he found in these big schools a kid would go through the whole day and no one would even talk to him. No one would even talk to him, they're so big. My wife would tell me at Whitaker, you know, the librarians, the custodians, and then, off the other way, all play a role in a kid's life. A librarian, and we always talk about the teacher. Well, you know, there's so many other adults in a school that can have an impact on a kid's life. But if they don't know the kids, because there's such a sea of humanity, it can't be this interaction. And that's the thing. We can talk class size. We've talked class size. We hammer class size. The truth of the matter is, it isn't class size. It's school size. It is school size is the issue. Now, smaller schools have better attendance and dropouts. I've talked about that. You know, it's interesting. Even Stan Bunn has been quoted as saying that he didn't think he could get any better education than he got at Dayton, when Dayton High School, small schools. He's torn by this because you can get in the financial aspects of it. But what they've found is that it costs more per student, you'll get that in smaller schools, unless you consider costs less per student who graduates. That's the key. If you say cost per student, it costs more. If you look at the cost per student who graduates, the studies are showing it costs the same or less if you have smaller schools. I did not bring the witnesses in here today. I don't think you're supposed to do that in Ways and Means, apparently. We brought in the experts from other, like Lewis and Clark or some other national experts who came and testified for the Senator Starr's committee, as well as the interim committee, that some cities, like Seattle, are going to existing office buildings and things and putting in schools. So you get away from the land, you have to purchase land, et cetera, to try to accommodate this. Finally, it's interesting. There was an article, a lot of articles have been done on the Oregonian recently on smaller schools. And I found it amazing, the editorial, which I'm struggling to find here now, the first two paragraphs were absolutely deafening. Oregon didn't set out to record one of the nation's worst dropouts rates, but knowingly created the huge, but it knowingly created the huge, rigid, and impersonal high schools that send many kids running for the exits. That's the opening paragraph, an editorial from the Oregonian. That's the disturbing truth at the core of this compelling series on school dropouts produced by a team of reporters for the Oregonian led by staff writer Bill Graves. The series concludes today. Over the past decades, Oregon citizens, elected officials, and school leaders repeatedly made choices they knew would lead to ever larger high schools and more crowded classrooms and fewer educational alternatives for the students. And now the full cost of their deliberate choices is becoming clear. Now listen, I'm not here to bash school board members or principals or superintendents or teachers. Their lives are, I don't know how they even survive. But I'm just begging you, if we did nothing else when it comes to education reform, but to create an incentive program or at least try to create an awareness on our school boards to try to keep high schools at no greater than 800, middle schools no bigger than 500, and elementary schools more bigger than 400, the impact on our students and our teachers and our parents and our superintendents and our principals, as well as the kids, would be unbelievably positive. The research shows it. You can go into Oregon, go to 1A high schools, go to 2A high schools, go to 3A high schools. Go. Go walk the hallways. And I will guarantee you, yeah, there are kids that are struggling in some of those schools. Come on, I'm not here to say otherwise. But the truth of the matter is, when I looked at the dropout rate, when I had my bill last session up, which said that if you don't come to school for a certain number of days, very controversial thing, got some help, I got it through, you could lose your license. When I looked at the dropout rate in our high schools, which is 25%, one out of four coming in ninth grade isn't going to graduate, overwhelmingly, the high dropout rates in the teens were in your big 4A high schools. That's where it was. It wasn't in your 2A, 1A, and even your 3A schools. So I don't know, I realize, here we are, economic forecast, what's coming out in a few days, it's going to be down. You're going to say, great, Peter, maybe you philosophically don't even agree with me. This isn't Peter. I've outlined for you in footnotes, the research, the people who've done the studies, it's all there. People who are certified smart, I'm not. There's no question I believe in this so strongly, I absolutely believe in this. My public schools in Salem-Keizer are too big, and it's taking a toll in my community. It's taking a toll across the state. And I just wish there was a way, at least we can't mandate it, but we can incentive it through incentives. My school board chair came in front of Senator Starr's committee, and she said herself, Peter's right. The new West Salem High School is going to be opened in West Salem. It's going to look beautiful. It's designed for up to 1,600 kids. And my chair of my school board said it's 800 bigger than it should be designed for. I mean, and by the way, for those of you who, of course, not everyone's here, I wish Senator Miller was here.
He's watching.
Is he? For those who think, watch this, for those who think that you can't get a Division I scholarship unless you're in a 4A school competition, yeah, he got injured. Sir Harrington took over, the quarterback coach, the famous coach, quarterback for U of O. A.J. Feely came out of Ontario High School. That's a 3A school. Harrington is out of Central Catholic. It's a 4A school, but it's got about 600 kids in it. I can go on. The number one draft this year by Oregon State for the football team came out of Scappoose. Check. The number one draft for U of O came out of Burns High School. The number one draft for their basketball team 2 years ago came out of Napa High School. I've looked at the Pac-10 schools, and I've looked also by the starting point guard for U of O came out of a little high school in Washington. The girl who led Notre Dame to the national championship, NCAA basketball, came out of a tiny high school in Kansas, 1A high school. So anybody wants to mess with me, you're going to take away. I need 4A high schools to make sure that my kid gets that Division I competition. I got news for you. I'll take you through the entire Pac-10. And I'll show you boys and girls who are competing at the highest level in sports who've come out of small schools. So I just, that's another little thing I just like to throw in there, because we have all these myths about bigger is better. Oh, yes, we do. Oh, our whole life is bigger and better. Everything's bigger and better. Well, when it comes to the education of our kids, when they're young like this, I'm sorry. I think there's overwhelming evidence that that is a major reason we've got dropout problems, we got teachers struggling, administrators struggling. So I beg you, Mr. Chair, first of all, I thank you very much. You did not have to hear this bill. I didn't think you'd hear this bill. I don't expect it to go anywhere. I'm going to get beat up over the cost, except, you know, what's the cost, folks? Yeah, I'm up in judiciary after this. I'm dealing with cost up there because of things that happen in education. So thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll take your criticisms, your comments, your questions.
Thank you, Peter. It's always a pleasure to have you before a committee or serving on a committee. I'm forever grateful for your efforts the last session on a number of bills, including the charter school bill, and I believe everything you say about small schools. But I must, now that the representative from the city of Salem is here, I must relate to you my high school experiences. To just only say that, you know, culture has changed dramatically in the last two generations. Oh. I graduated from Jefferson High School in June of 1945, the largest high school in the state, 2,500 students, and we were the best in everything, academics and athletics. Today, Jefferson High School has less than 800 students. And on the report card that came out, it's the poorest performing high school in the state, according to the new report card. So that, I'm not trying to refute your idea that it's all you have to do is reduce your high school to 800 and you've got it made. It depends on the area, the community. And but I believe in what you say. You mentioned Westview High School. It's in my Senate district. There's four other high schools. And they average, I think, those five schools have close to 10,000 students in them total. And, you know, if we went to 800, we'd have to build five new high schools. And as you suggested, that's not economically feasible. But I think we need to continue the pressure to reduce school size. I think it requires a special kind of a superintendent, a school board, and principals and teachers and community members to accomplish what I know that the schools that you're talking about, the size, can do. But I hope you won't get discouraged, and even though you're termed out, well, I hope you'll join with me to carry this battle on as we talk about building high schools, which we surely will continue to do. But I thank you very much for the work that you've done and the work that you'll do. Any other comments, questions? Yes, Representative Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Courtney, did I understand you to say that you felt that school size was more important or critical to student achievement than class size?
I did say that. Chair Hartung, I did say that because that's a dramatic statement, but I believe that if your schools are the right size, the other things will take care of themselves within the school. Remember what I said about teachers and administration? And so many times, you know, a kid spends a lot of time outside of the class, and we've grown to think it's all the relationship between the student and the teacher, which is the key. And what bothers me is when you do that, you become so focused on that you don't recognize all the other players in a school. And if your school is a smaller size, then everything else feeds off of that. Everything grows from that in a positive way. So I will make that dramatic statement. I mean, you can. I don't make it in a vacuum, though. It's related to every other part of a student's life. It's from the moment they enter that school to the moment they leave it that day, whether it's at 3 o'clock or after they've gone to practice or been to play practice or band practice. And so much of what's going on in these young people's mind is not just a teacher in a classroom. It's their relationship to other administrators and other people in the building, I'm convinced, as well as their students under certain situations. And I think, therefore, if the size of the school is a certain number and no bigger, everything else takes care of itself. Yeah, I did make that statement.
Okay. Senator Trump.
Generally, Peter, I agree with you, and I think size is an important factor, but I don't think it's the only factor. I've taught in in very small schools. When I taught in Kansas at the high school, I'm talking mostly always about high schools now, and in a medium-sized school in Kansas. And then when I went to Colorado, I taught in a high school that needed clearly to build additional schools because it was too large. And it was teaching at a very small school, 50 students. I thought it was a good school. I thought we did a lot. But one of the things I thought we tried to do in our extracurricular activities was to do so many things the big schools did that those 50 kids were just overloaded with things they did, to the point where their academic life suffered, because you had to have all the plays, you had to have all the orchestra and the band and all the athletic events and all of those things. And with 50 students, you it was very difficult to do all of those things. And so I think schools can be too small sometimes to be effective. I think with regard to the Boulder High School, it was about 1,600, something like that. And when we talked about the need for a new school, we said that, well, maybe the optimum size for Boulder High would be 1,200. I don't know, I don't think we thought about 800. But they did build another school eventually there, another high school, so that it was possible to reduce the high school down a bit. Where does the 800 come from? When, that was a long time ago when I was doing this, but the idea then was about 1,200 was the optimum size for a high school in a larger city. Does the 800 come from somebody's research that says that's the best number?
Chair Hartung, Senator Cho, that's correct.
Is it? Okay. I hadn't seen that research.
I think probably what they're looking at is if you're from 9 through 12, it's 200 in a class.
Mm-hmm.
Also, Senator Cho, I'm not promoting the construction of just 1A high schools. I think you have in front of me all the 4A, 3A, 2A, 1A schools in the state of Oregon listed. You become a 4A high school, and there are some exceptions, after you get to about the 800. It's ironic, you become a 4A high school when you reach 800 in the state of Oregon. So here I am saying no school should be bigger than 800 if it's a high school. That's how you get to 4A. Anything under 800, more or less, is a 3A, 2A, or 1A. Please remember, committee, I'm not talking just about high schools, though. There's the middle school issue and the elementary school. So if nothing else, you maybe want to target one of those, because kids are being impacted all the way through.
Mm-hmm.
So these discussions always go back to the high school, but you do have the middle school and the high school situation, I mean elementary. And there is a lot of thinking going on in research that it's the middle school is the critical area. That is the area you desperately don't want to get too crowded. You don't want to get too crowded. I really mean that. That's become, and if you talk to teachers, that scares them more than big high schools.
Mr. Chair, I agree with that as well. And I do think size of school does have a lot to do, although I don't think that size determines whether or not necessarily you have a good school. I think the quality of some other things really have to do with that, the quality of the teachers and the good administration and so forth, whether or not you have a good school. But when you come down to what you're going to do about it, if districts have schools that are too large, a lot of districts have schools that are too large, not because they thought bigger was better, but somehow or other it was a matter of finance and having enough money to provide all of the schools and history and some other kinds of things, so that they end up with some schools that are too large. What you're suggesting here is that where a school district has a large school, it has to ask for a waiver, and the board then will grant a waiver if it's demonstrated compelling reasons for not meeting the maximum school size requirement. And presumably where you've got schools, I don't know, I imagine both the Corvallis high schools are too big and maybe some of the other schools. Mm-hmm. I don't think the rest of the schools are, though, as a matter of fact, in Corvallis. They're probably not that large. So they ask for the waiver. You say you can only have the waiver for a specified length of time. What do you mean by that? Is that a year? Is that 2 years? Is that 3 years? What if a community can't get their people to vote a bond issue to build a new school? Well, what about those economic factors?
Chair Hartung, Senator Cho, whatever you want to do would be fine. If this committee, its wisdom, would pass out, if nothing else, a directive. If you want to say the waiver is, I always get Washington County brought up. I'm sorry, Chair Hartin. I always get Washington County. You know, Peter, there's nothing like Washington County. I mean, you know, it's nice, but it won't work. I say, all right. Does that mean it won't work any other place? I mean, and you know, I'm not trying to engineer every single school district or not, you know, every place is different. But I do feel that the discussion about the size of schools needs to take place at every single school board, and they ought to seriously try to figure out, if we're going to build a new school, can we keep it this size? And if we can't, why? And then go before the department head or some kind of review board, and so be it. Or as well as taking a look at existing schools and saying school size has got to be an issue. Senator, I think we did make a decision as a society to go bigger and better. It was more than just money. It was more than money. I think there is the perception. If you think about our lives, the Costco mentality, the way we go to theaters, everything that we do, every decision that we make and have made in our society, if you look at it, not just in schools, is we go to bigger is better. And so I think it was more than just finances that drove us to this position. We believe that we could get more pool of talents, better facilities, and therefore it was better for the kids to have these kinds of mega campuses. And I believe it was more than just money. I really do. And the research shows that. It was a conscious decision.
But even so, I think that money has something to do with your ability to meet these standards. And a lot of cities simply can't meet these standards very easily or very readily without a lot of willingness on the people of the communities to assume more of a burden for the schools, or unless the state can pungle up some money, or the federal government will, or somebody will, so that we can build schools so that we can keep the size at the numbers you're suggesting. So I guess what I wouldn't want to see happen with this, I like what you say about what it will do, because I think it will cause people to talk about this and maybe do something about it if they can afford to do something about it. But what I don't want to happen is that if a school district has some large schools, that somehow or other they now get branded as being simply too large to be effective or to do a good job, and that somehow or other that attitude about them prevails other places, and affects their ratings, affects what people think about schools. Because I think there can be some big schools that are pretty good. I think there are some.
I sense you want to do other things. Mr. Chair, the article came out in the Oregonian just last month about Rex Putnam High School. It starts out by saying almost every day a high school principal somewhere in the United States calls Dino Edwards, the principal of Rex Putnam High School. The Milwaukee school has become an example of how a big suburban high school can serve out smaller settings to help students better connect with the teachers and one another. Now, that's what you're saying. It's interesting about Rex Putnam. It has 1,350 students in it, 1,350, so it's over the 800. And you go through with all the accomplishments of this individual, his principal, what he's done. But I think the most compelling statement he makes, and it was the last statement he makes. It doesn't really make sense. I don't know if you quite know what he says here. They say he's getting ready to retire, et cetera, et cetera, and they're begging him not to retire. He's the typical good old boys, but he's done a remarkable job in Rex Putnam High School. Truly, he has. This job is too big, Edward said. I don't mean the principal's job. I mean the job of educating 1,050 kids in a way too big for one person. I think what he was saying there, he came out of North Salem High School and he had 3,000 kids over here. And he vowed that he would not let that happen as he went through Linfield and then got in coaching in sports. Here's a man, it's at Rex Putnam, which is a success. He is taking a bigger school, nowhere near the size of Westview, which is 2,300 kids, or Sprague out here, which is nearly 2,200 kids, or South, which is 2,100 kids. He's got 1,350, dramatically less. He's a nationally renowned principal because of what he's doing, making it smaller. Yet he's saying at 1,350, because if you look at the genesis statement, it's too big. So I'm even borrowing from our own experts in this state that we can, as adults, we can talk about expense and cost. But you've got a dropout rate here that's astronomical in the state, one of the worst in the country. I know there's all kinds of reasons that everybody's got an answer. This is a very simple statement, a very, very simple statement. And I think size has everything to do with it. Don't forget, my wife said to me, you know, in the big schools, the only kids you notice are the stars, the ones that get in trouble. That's fine. What about all those kids that go through the day never feeling good about themselves? They come out of school never really understanding the talents that they may have later on, and the damage has been done forever. They'll never reach for the stars. There's a sea of kids in this discussion that we usually don't think about. We think about the kids that are dropping out in trouble. The tragedy about this discussion is the sea of kids that go through the day, nobody hardly talks to them. They never feel special. They're just one of many. And you cannot get around that once you reach a certain critical mass. You cannot get around that. You cannot. And that's the thing I think is sad about big schools. And I really do. I really, really do. And this state is a remarkable state for 1A, 2A, 3A schools. I've been involved in all the different levels because of my kids. I've had the advantage of my kids now are in a 1A school going to a 2A. I've been in the 2A competition, but I've also involved the 4A. And I can tell you, and I'm going to give this South Salem commencement address. I know just exactly what I'm going to say. I just was at McNary last week. And I can tell you, these are big, mega high schools. And there's an awful lot of kids that aren't getting in trouble, but they're not finding the potentials. And years go by. They're 18. Even if they graduate, maybe. I just think that we should do as much as we can, if nothing else, give directives or incentives. And I don't want to condemn existing schools, grandfather men, but I sure don't know what's wrong with making a statement about it.
Thank you, Peter. Representative Winston?
Yeah, Peter, I share a lot of your concerns, and I also think that in some respects, smallness, whether we're talking small classroom sizes, you look at the report that I did in the interim and talking about the ability for teachers to interact and relate. But I also share the concern that was raised by Senator Hartung, because we do have smaller schools. I mean, we looked at Jefferson, and that is a small population. And yet, inside there, we're talking about a failed school, even with the smallness. So smallness alone, I don't think, is the total answer. But I do share your focus, and I do believe that we should be given a lot more debate and discussion, whether we're talking smaller classrooms or whether we're talking smaller campuses. Just wanted to add that. But that alone is not the answer.
Chair Hartung, Representative Winters, I agree, but I would say smallness alone is not the answer, but without smallness, I don't think you can get there. You cannot get there. It's got to be in the mix.
Peter, next Tuesday and Wednesday, this committee will be holding hearings on school funding because we're going to get the May forecast, and I'm inviting you back. We're going to have public hearings Tuesday and Wednesday. I want to hear more about cost, about what you would be doing, and I throw at you also, you know, there are large high schools that are organizing their school in academies, for instance, and I don't know, maybe that's a possibility in the interim, but I wish you'd give it some thought. You're very creative, and you can get fire in the belly for no reason at all. So here's a good reason. Excuse that remark. No, for good reason. That's what I meant to say. But you are invited back next Tuesday or Wednesday if you have more good ideas like you've had today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members.
You bet. Okay, I close the public hearing on Senate Bill 38 and open the public hearing on Senate Bill 100. Senator Deckert and Treasurer Randall Edwards, would you please come forward? Senator Deckert, I'm sorry you weren't here for all of Peter's presentation. It was really very good. It's on tape if you need to see it.
On video and audio, or just the highlights?
Well, welcome to the committee, gentlemen. And
thank you, Senator.
Senator Deckert, proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, it's an honor to be back before this committee. I think, you know, the most pointed example I can give for Senate Bill 100, and I'd like to talk a little bit about the bill, was in today's Oregonian. It's in the technology section. I think it's about the fourth or fifth page. but there's a Q&A with the CFO of Electric Science Industries, ESI, and they ask him in that Q&A, what is the decision, or what is the rationale for the decision not to expand in the Portland metropolitan area? And his answer, and I'm not going to get it perfectly, but it's in today's technology section, was, we would have spent $2 billion more in Oregon expanding, but the one thing, that one factor that we considered was the lack of engineers. And to me, that should be front page, because if you look at decisions that will affect our lives as Oregonians for the next 20 or 30 years, if they had decided to do a $2 billion expansion in Oregon, the repercussions would have been on the magnitude of Intel. And we know the big investment that they've made in our community. The idea behind Senate Bill 100 is at least in part to achieve keeping ESI and growing our talent here in Oregon. Jim Johnson from Intel, I had breakfast with him about 7 months ago, and he broached me with the idea of co-sponsoring this with Senator Hartung. And it's very simply the notion of what Georgia did, which is guaranteeing their students who achieve a B average or better a seat in Oregon's colleges or universities. And here's what happened in Georgia, and here's the positive tale of what happened. 76% of Georgia high school students with combined SAT scores greater than 1,500, 76% now attend college in Georgia. That is compared to 23% of students with SAT scores greater than 1,500 in 1992. So they have tripled the number of students who are staying in Georgia, and we've seen the statistics of what happens when you attend college in state. You do stay, by and large. You do invest. You buy homes, and you grow the economy of that state. They have tripled the number of graduates that are now staying in state and calling Georgia their home through the Hope Scholarship Program. In Georgia, high school grades and SAT scores have risen since the Hope started, and the percentage of first-time college students requiring remedial courses has decreased. Hope prompted an 11% increase in enrollment of freshmen, mostly in four-year colleges, and a 24% increase in African-American students at state and universities, with a 12% increase of African-American students at private universities. Less financial aid is coming in the form of grants. People with college degrees who are best prepared for the workforce, regardless of financial need. And that's where I would put the last point, because I think this committee is well-versed in terms of keeping the best and brightest students in state, and I think this bill is your greatest tool, the greatest tool that you could have of assuring any child in the state of Oregon that if they work hard and they play by the rules, we have a seat in Oregon's institutions for them. The two things that came out of the Senate Education Committee that I think were very important is, one, that we bring new money to the table, and I think that's very important in terms of the success of this program, and also that we fully fund the opportunity grant so that we ensure that this complements our need-based program, which has been very, very effective in assuring that we have a diversity on campus and assuring that all students are able to take advantage of Oregon's institutions. But with those two caveats of finding new resources and fully funding the opportunity grant, I think Oregon could do nothing more proactive and effective way of ensuring that we triple the numbers, and that companies like ESI, instead of deciding to look elsewhere, come back and look at Oregon again as a place where the best and brightest stay and do business.
Thank you, Senator. And the members, I'd like to hold the questions for Senator Deckert until we hear from Treasurer Edwards. Randall, welcome to the committee, and thank you for what you did as an ordinary person before you were elected to such a high spot.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Randall Edwards, State Treasurer of Oregon, and it's a pleasure to be here again before your committee on a different matter. And I'm here in part because, as State Treasurer, I already have a foot in the door in trying to help Oregonians achieve their dream of going to college at any level, both private and public, and that is, I'm the administrator of the Oregon College Savings Plan, which, as you recall, we were all involved last session in passing legislation to help create this savings account, which allows families, individuals, to put thousands of dollars away with tax benefits for college. And there will be a bill before the Senate, it's passed the House, that will make those investments state income tax free, and I'm hoping that will pass the Senate and become law.
This morning, didn't it?
Did it come through today?
One of the bills did. Barely.
Was that the one? Right?
Yeah,
it was, right.
Yeah.
It finally passed after
a few votes. After a few people change votes.
Right. Yes, it did.
Well, I'm glad it passed. Thank you for telling me.
We had a lot of people absent today. Would have absent otherwise. More.
The fact of the matter is I'm here in part to say that obviously helping families, individuals achieve the need and the dream of attaining a higher educational degree is important to me, not only as somebody who's involved in managing this program, but also as somebody involved in the state's finances. And it is clear when you look at the statistics that having a higher level of education is becoming a greater and greater need in our society. And any way in which we as a state can help individuals achieve that, it's critical. What I'm here to talk about just briefly is the plan outlined in Senate Bill 100. My counterpart in Nevada, the Treasurer of Nevada, manages a plan very similar to what is going on in Georgia, except that the funding in this case came from the tobacco settlement. Nevada's legislature passed recently a millennium scholarship program. 40% of their tobacco settlements went into paying for this program. Again, another tool if you were to look at financing this idea of giving individuals in the state an opportunity to attend college with a B or better average. Again, similar in the Georgia plan, and that is for residents for who've been here for 2 years, again, maintaining a 3-point GPA. And again, this has been a very, very successful program in Nevada. The mechanics, it does require that the scholarships are $40 per credit at a community college as well as an $80 per credit at a university. They capped it out at $10,000 total for any one student. And interestingly enough, some ways, and I think if we were to proceed in, with a HOPE scholarship in this state, is how do you implement it? There's obviously a few questions. One, how do you finance it? And as Senator Deckert just outlined, I think when you move a major policy forward like this, you want to make sure you're not taking away from current programs, particularly around funding need-based programs, which are critical to the state. The interesting side effect of the success in Nevada was it actually created an enormous demand to go to college, such an enormous demand in Nevada to go to college that their universities have had a hard time finding housing. It's had sort of a lot of secondary effects. Again, getting people to go to school, but I think they opened the doors wide open, and as a result, they had some challenges and continue to have challenges to make sure that they can accommodate the demand that was created by this. And I think the bottom line for all of us is that as you go forward, how do you finance this? And I think, you know, this is a critical piece of making this work for the state if you were to move forward. And again, it's to make sure that we balance how this program would affect the need-based programs, where we would come up with the money. But I think the policy and the idea, as Senator Deckert outlined earlier, and the intent of this bill is to give individuals an opportunity, another tool to provide them an opportunity to go to college in some degree. That, I think, is something long-term the state needs to continue to look at. It is becoming a daunting challenge for individuals and families to afford college, and yet the demand for a higher level of education is getting greater and greater, and as a result, we in the state need to pay attention long term how we're going to meet those two diametrically opposed needs, and that is the cost versus the driving need in the workplace to have a higher level of education. So I'm here to answer any questions. I appreciate the opportunity to testify before you. I have some information I handed out about the Nevada program. Again, that's another model you can look at. It's been very successful.
Thank you, Randall. Do you know if Nevada, they have comparable opportunities or new grant scholarship program like we do in this state?
Mr. Chair, I'm not positive about that. I'd have to get back to you on that.
Could you put our staff in touch with whomever in Nevada would have all that information, I suppose, the Department of Education. Mm-hmm. And I'm really curious also to know if they have, you know, institutions of higher education that are the same, you know, high quality that I say we have in our publics and private. And but anyway, we'll
sure. Be happy to do that, Mr. Chair.
Steve, that'd be fine. Other questions or comments?
Only that, Mr. Chair, I think it should ask both Georgia and Nevada.
Okay. Yeah, I think, Senator Deckert, you, your staff got quite a bit of information on Georgia.
Yeah,
okay, we'll get that information for the committee. Senator Trow?
There are a lot of merit-based scholarships already. I know not enough to go around by a long shot, but a lot of them. Do you get this one in and another one too, or how does it work? Does this one substitute for, let's say, a presidential scholarship that might be given at OSU to an Oregon student, which would pay for the same things and maybe more? How does it work?
Mr. Chair, Senator Trow, excellent question. I think that was one of the first questions we had, is in putting it together to assure that you never forego a dime of federal or other private money that you might be able to. So you would never want to take tax dollars and replace them with any other private or federal source. And so at least that's been the driving momentum in terms of putting this bill together, is to assure that we only augment and never take from any other source of funding, to ensure that we're just adding to the pot and providing more opportunities, with the key being that we entice students to stay here in Oregon.
So does the bill say that? Does the bill?
I don't have it in front of me. I believe, at least in drafting it, we tried to put language in there that, that achieves that.
Okay. One of the things that might happen, I don't know whether it has or not, and you know maybe the history of places where this already exists, where they have, in addition to the Hope Scholarship that's been implemented, an opportunity grant or a need grant, is that when there's not enough money to go around somehow or other, even if you bring new money to the table, there's not enough to do both, and the opportunity grant suffers because of that, or the need grant does. Is there a track record about that, and how do we keep that from happening? Because I think we have a real reason to be concerned about kids maybe that don't do as well in high school for a whole lot of factors that maybe aren't completely under their control,
mm-hmm.
and want a second chance. Go on to higher ed. Some kids turn around between public school experience and higher ed experience and do a tremendously good job if they get a chance. So what about those questions? How do you deal with those?
Mr. Chair, Senator Trow, in our hearings in the Senate Education Committee, because I really see them as separate questions, and you have the question of the merit-based program, in some ways of enticing students and keeping the best and the brightest in state. And to me, that's why I started off with the example of the $2 billion investment that is not happening in Oregon because of the engineering capacity and quality that we have in the state. You have that discussion. And so what we chose to do, Senator Hartung and myself and Senate Education Committee, is say we really see this as two separate conversations. That discussion, put a wall up and say, how do we deal with those students? And if Jim Johnson was here today, what we had talked about with him was finding new money and asking the corporate community to help fund it. But if we taxed them, or if they came to the table with a new revenue source for this, that there would be a wall on it, and that never would it go, that it would go solely to fund programs like this that really would benefit, I think, all of Oregon's economy and generate more revenues, so that we can do the other step, and that's where the other side of the wall is increase our commitment to the opportunity grant to help students that maybe don't fit the criteria, and there are a lot of them. Mm-hmm. If we abandon them, we do know where we see them, and it would be an unwise move on the behalf of Oregon to abandon them, because you will see the cost. It just won't be in your education system, we'll see. And so it would be fully funding that and then turning the dime over, and how do you get funding for a new merit-based scholarship separately?
Yeah, I like that intention, and I think that's the way to do it, if you're going to do it. The danger is, living in the climate we live in, where you have not enough general fund to go around, and a real problem. And if it's going to be another general fund program primarily, I don't know. If you're thinking you're going to raise private money for it, that's great. I don't know that you can, enough of it anyway. So if it's another general fund program, there's not enough general fund to go around between all of our needs, and we have continuing folks who want to change the tax system to benefit one group or another at the expense of the general fund. I don't know how you do both without, when we don't finance one well enough right now to do two and finance them adequately. So that's what I'm scared about. I like the idea. I commend you for the idea. Probably support it. I would vote to get the money to do it, but I don't know that there are enough folks who would do that to keep the funding spigot open.
Senator Representative Schrader.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I'm a strong supporter of this bill. I'm on this bill and actually introduced two other variations in the session to do similar type of objective. And I think it is important. We need the balance. I do not buy into the mentality that we can't improve a lot and the opportunities for a lot of different types of Oregonian students out there. And to improve jobs, to improve prospects, I think this bill gets Oregon down the line. We're starting to compete even in a tough economy with some businesses that may want to come here if we show that we're willing to step up to the plate. And I think part of the answer to the concern that we've heard and we'll hear more about taking away from the general fund is to perhaps encourage the business community to step up again. And maybe opportunities, funding sources that employers and corporations fund almost exclusively that may provide us with some opportunities for revenue that are not yet used in the general fund, not part of the general fund, that might get us down the line a little bit to starting at least some seed money to start this program. We'd have to put some sidebars to encourage, with a limited amount of money to get this thing going, to fund it appropriately and make sure it targets the best and the brightest. I think the data is pretty straightforward. Looking at the different states that have enacted this, the scores have improved, the students have decided to stay in state, and in general, where the legislature and the state as a whole has gotten behind it, there could be some opportunities. I'm very sensitive to the wall issue. I'm also sensitive to the fact that when any time, anywhere, under any circumstance, if you give money away to anybody, that they have a responsibility to perform. And I feel that very, very strongly. I think that's what's wrong with our country today in general. It's what's bringing Oregon down, is that we do not have any accountability in our system. Something like this starts down that road where not only do we help instill some pride, some ownership on the part of those individuals where they have a responsibility in return for a great opportunity to attend some great colleges here in the state of Oregon, but we also start to build a great job base and a great economy and bring this state further along than we ever had before. So I think there's some opportunities. I'm a strong supporter of this and hope we can come up with some creative solutions to find the funding source that gets us started here.
Thank you. Other comments? Questions?
Mr. Chair, just on that point.
Certainly.
Well, let me just say one thing. I think, obviously, these were bold moves by these two states, and this is sort of out of the box thinking about advancing in those two states higher educational needs. And as somebody said in the dais, talking about, it also starts to break down that division between K-12 and higher ed, which in the end, what you're really saying is we are willing to help you as a citizen go through and get that higher level of education, which we currently guarantee at K-12, if you basically are at certain standards. And in a lot of ways, and of course you still have the needs-based needs as well, but the idea is that at the end, we're trying to educate our citizens the long haul, and as we all know, high school degrees aren't enough anymore. I mean, you've got to have additional training, and whether it's technical or otherwise, this begins forcing that debate about really what are our responsibilities to help educate our population.
Mr. Chair, just want to add to that discussion, because I think you're absolutely correct, and even with need-based, I think we should be pushing to have high standards. I don't think need necessarily negates that one's GPA should be at in the toilet. I think it should be the expectation that we are expecting higher standards when we're talking about the institution of higher learning. So I think we're on the right track. And the bigger question is, where do we find the dollars to get the train going?
But I would hope that we, even with the need base, that we begin to really begin to talk about standards and elevating our expectations. We're doing this in K through 12. And you know, we really begin to look. We're saying in Oregon that no longer are we going to be satisfied with mediocrity. And so I just want to say it's a good bill to come forward.
Thank you. I just wanted to add one additional thing.
Certainly.
It's on Representative Schrader's point, because I think it really does change the mindset in some ways when you institute at least this way of thinking, is that 70% of the HOPE recipients in Georgia have stayed in the program, and we wrote it in this bill that you must maintain a 2.7 GPA your first year, a 3 following that. So really, that's the bargain. The state has an interest in you, and you have an interest in the state. And 70% of the students are staying in the program and achieving at levels that they weren't previously achieving because I think the state helped them make sometimes a better choice. And so at least in notion, I think this really does, on several fronts, advance the ball for our system of higher education.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Trobe,
and I don't know enough about Georgia to be fair in judging Georgia, and it's great to hear those statistics about fat people are staying, but I do know that historically Georgia schools have not been at a very high level. A lot of folks, especially minority folks, have not gotten a very good education in those schools, and maybe don't have the academic average that other folks have in those schools that maybe better. So I wonder if this kind of program works in a way that would be easier for some folks to make the grade and get the college education, and not so easy for others. And has there been any studies along those lines in that program there?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Senator Trow, from 1993 to 1998, 25% more, I think it's 24% more African-American students attended the state universities, which I think is a real success in itself there, is that you have a quarter more, 25.
I haven't seen those studies, so that's encouraging.
Increase, which to me at least gives evidence that we're doing the right things across the board. And I think it's also essential that you fund, never should this be at the expense of an opportunity grant.
I agree.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Appreciate your time and efforts, and even though the session will adjourn sometime, we're not done with this yet, but I really appreciate your efforts. And we have a few minutes. I'd like to have a representative from the Oregon Student Association and the Oregon Community College Association give you each about 5 or 7 minutes. We do have your written testimony in opposition to Senate Bill 100, but I'd like to hear your statements about why you do oppose it. So, welcome, John Wyckoff and Rim. Please identify yourself. And incidentally, members, you have LFO that I took a look at also. So, John, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Hartung, members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to speak before you today. And some of you have heard most of this testimony before, and we'll try to keep it brief. And Representative Schrader knows the argument fairly well, may not agree with every point of it, but I do just want to go over a couple of points. I think for the Oregon Student Association, one of our key hopes with this bill is that if you are going to move forward with it, you will have a chance to take another look at some of the policy points on this bill, because currently as written, a student would have to deduct their federal aid from the bill. This would mean that a family making $145,000, for instance, would have a child that would likely get a larger award than a family who makes $20,000 a year, because they would have to deduct their federal aid, which is how the bill reads. That's obviously a concern that we're going to have, that a wealthier family would have a student getting a larger award than a very poor family. So that's a concern we would definitely hope would be addressed. We're obviously concerned that this could, and this is one of the experiences that states have had that have introduced these kinds of programs, and this is especially true in Georgia. Georgia used to have a need-based program, and now does not at all. There is almost no money in need-based aid in Georgia now. Another issue in Georgia that got brought up in the last time this bill was heard was that since the inception of HOPE, the dropout rate in high schools in Georgia has increased 10.5%, making it one of the highest dropout rates in the country. And so there are definitely some other sides to this. I think another point, I mean, currently Oregon has a merit-based award based on the SIM and CAM, so we would urge the committee to look at the existing program. We think that it might be redundant, in that context. We're concerned because 11,000 students are currently turned away from a need-based program, for which there is a merit standard. You must maintain a C average and pass classes. I think we would argue for a lot of students who have very differing needs, that C average, that's not something to be ashamed of. C is an average grade because an awful lot of people get C's, and people that are working very hard and have families and have a lot of other issues in their lives struggle to get those C's, and we don't think that they should be discouraged from getting an education, because the committee is absolutely right. That education is vitally important to getting ahead in life and getting a better income, and we want to make sure that those students have as much access as possible, and we're concerned that introducing another program now may stretch resources even thinner for all these programs, especially when we consider that we're coming upon possibly $1 billion shortfall in the next biennium. Just a couple of other points. There are definitely mixed results over this program. I mean, there are a lot of I think, unintended consequences when you introduce programs like this. Now, Thomas Mortensen, who's a senior scholar with the Center for Study of Opportunity in Higher Education, recently told Knight Ritter News Service that in 1980, students whose families were in the top income quartile earned five times as many bachelor's degree by the age of 24 as students who were in the bottom quartile. Today, he said that gap has jumped to eight times. And he was having this discussion in the context of merit-based aid and other programs like the Federal Lifelong Learning Tax Credit, and programs that tend to go to families who pay income tax, who have a little more income. I think there are some other mixed results that you want to look at in merit-based aid. While from 1993 to 1998, the number of Georgia high school students earning a core course GPA of 3.0 or above rose to a 3.63, I think I said that wrong, rose from 3.0 and or above rose from 3.63% to just over 50%. So over 50% we're now getting the 3.63. But on the other side, from the University of Georgia, we can see information that doesn't seem to confirm these numbers. Incoming freshmen from the University of Georgia, their SAT scores only fluctuated during that period, going from 1,086 and 93 up to 1,019 in 1995, and then dropping to a 1,090 and 97. So there was only fluctuation at best in the numbers of SAT scores. On the issue of brain drain, where you lose your best and brightest students, the state did find that they were losing, that went down 2%. They were at one point losing 26%, then that went down to 24%. In Virginia, another example, they recently just phased out a $3,000 program, $3,000 scholarship for the state's top high school students because there was no interest in it. And I guess the argument I would throw out there is that going to maybe the example that Senator Deckard gave, maybe the best way to keep high-performing students in programs like engineering is to try to create high-performing engineering programs. If we want to keep the best and brightest students in certain programs, we need some of the best programs, and maybe that's something to consider.
As if we haven't considered that?
I'm sure the committee has, and I know they have, but just to
we haven't created them yet.
We're working on it.
But
excuse me for interrupting.
But thank you, Senator. I mean, that's a valid point, and you're absolutely right. But we think that might be the better approach. We're also obviously concerned because some folks are just going to do better under this kind of a proposal than others. These programs tend to favor high and medium income students who tend to get those grades. And some minority students, some minority groups who have a disproportionately high rate of poverty don't do well under a situation like this. That's another concern we have. And the rest, I think, is in my written testimony. I'll leave it at that and be happy to take any questions.
Senator?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, a question on your attachment one on your UCLA study on percentage of college freshmen with high school grade point averages. What's the date of this study?
This is Chair Hartung, Representative Winters. I believe it's 1998, but let me get back to you. It's a fairly recent. It may be as early as 1995.
Because the reason I asked that, because when I look at the definitions that are being used, there are definitions that aren't used currently, because you have Chicano, which is not a terminology that really is used for the Hispanic population. So I'm trying to figure out when this was done. And would you check those dates for me?
We'd be happy to.
Yes, Representative Schrader.
I'd just like to remind the committee a little bit that, kind of round out John's testimony, that actually there are no dollars in our achievement grant program at this point in time. So whether you call it Hope Scholarship or merit-based or achievement grant, I mean, it's there and that's fine, but we don't have any dollars in it. And it's a good comment, though. Maybe there should be some way of melding what we already have with what's being proposed. That's very good. The other comment that was made that we already have to have a C average to get an E grant, that's not actually correct. It's a the statute says satisfactory progress, and then talking to the various institutions you don't have to have a C average to actually get there. You can vary a little bit in the type of progress. It's up to the institution more than any, you know, general standard that we have. The other thing that kind of bothers me a little bit, and maybe I get it wrong, but like page 5 of the document, and John alluded to it, merit programs tend to help those students who are middle and upper income. This especially affects minority communities, which experience disproportionately high levels of poverty. It seems to be an implicit comment in that if you're a poor or a minority person, you can't achieve. I guess I find that a little bit insulting. I mean, if I was poor, and if I was a minority member, and I guess I have a Latino background in myself, I'd like to think that you can achieve regardless of that. Yes, it may be more difficult. Like, there's no doubt about that. You have certain things that are tough to deal with, perhaps. But I find that a little insulting, and I would hope that no matter who you are in this country and in Oregon, you have, you know, if you have a little motivation, and that, not talking just dollars, but good teachers, good programs have been alluded to, that you can achieve regardless. So I just not real keen on that.
Sure.
Reasoning.
Senator Trill.
Yeah. I guess the reality is, though, in this country that people are getting poorer, rather a whole group of people are getting poorer, have fewer advantages than they used to have. That's why it's important to give advantages to people. If we want people to believe in this country, we can't create a bifurcated country in which 80% of the people are poor and 20% of the people are wealthy. We've got to give opportunities. And that's why I think that you bend over backwards to give some opportunities in society if you want to keep it going. And I don't think to say to people who haven't had anybody ever go to college, who don't know much about what happens in college, that we're not saying those people aren't capable of doing things. What we're saying is if we give them advantages, many of them will find capabilities they never dreamed they had before, and we'll use them. And so that's why I just think that we need to think about that. I don't think the problem is merit. I think we got a lot of people who demonstrate merit all the time, who have lots of money, who can afford to go to college. And there are a lot of scholarships for those people already. There aren't a whole lot of scholarships for those people who are down and out and poor. And that's what we need. That's where I think this society needs to lend a helping hand.
Senator, I would agree with most everything you said, but I would respectfully disagree with a couple of things that you said there. And, you know, we can't have world-class institutions in our 7 institutions of higher education unless we keep our best and brightest students here. And I say this from personal experience in recruiting a young man from Westview High School who was scheduled to go out of state for engineering, but I took him down to Oregon State, introduced him to Ron Adams. They put together a special, this would have to be considered a merit-based opportunity, but he would have been gone. And now this young man will go to school here, and I'm sure he'll get one of the better jobs. So I'm not willing to, I agree that we need to have, need grants, opportunity grants, but I'm not willing to put all of our money into that to the detriment of a merit-based scholarship where we can keep our very best and brightest students. And I criticize myself and you, and I criticize John. You know, we listen to ourselves in this building so much. You listen to, the people you work with and whatnot so much. You don't really understand, like a lot of us don't understand, what goes on outside the building and the 4,000 issues that we have in bills here. But I think if you would have some way to aggressively recruit, our best and brightest students, and that doesn't mean that they have to come from Westview High School of Beaverton. You go over to Jefferson High School and you'll find some kids. And when I say you, I don't mean you necessarily, but I mean those of you who will promote the need and the opportunity grants here. This country didn't get great and remaining the last great world power by having a mediocre or an average schools of education. In fact, I say our public education, where there are incentives to succeed, that's why this country is great.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
For 20 years, my wife and I have funded a presidential scholar at OSU. You have as well. You know you're getting the best and the brightest when you do that, and you're putting money on merit. And I believe in doing that and have done it, to demonstrate that. But I also think we ought to give a helping hand. I'm someone who never got any money to go to school. I worked my way through.
Mm-hmm.
And I appreciate the fact that people do need some help. People come from a lot poorer families than I came from.
Senator Hertzog, I have to respond because I think that certainly we do need to offer help, but I think that we also need to make sure that merit and standards are there. I get a little troubled, and I'm going to key off of Representative Schrader. It appears often that when we couch the words of poverty or minorities or whatever, there's a connotation surrounding it as though somehow, and it's not just the helping hand, but they can't do any better. And I get very offended by it because that is not true. And the expectations of merit should exist whether we're talking in or Albina. Senator Hart and I sit here and we just kind of bleed, if you will, that where we came from as a community, where the standards were high, extremely high.
Expectations.
And the expectations were high. And then we hear these terminologies of you can't expect any more over that. We've got to, I don't think that that's accurate, because I think that any institution that we have in this state, that we should have the standards that says it is our expectation that you could learn. I said, the one thing that every child can learn, if we give them the tools with which to develop and which to grow. And so, I just wanted to put that on record because it just troubles me. Maybe we need to change our terminology of how we deal and address some of the issues within the community. We're having the same discussion when we talk about culture competency. And that goes into our institutions of when we teach. We teach somehow that if you have to go into the inner cities, that you have to pat those kids on the head because somehow they're less than advantage and they can't do any better. And if I do nothing else this session, I would love to get the message out that every child can learn. We do not have to treat them different. We don't have to think about them different. We just need to provide the tools with which they could learn.
I don't think anybody would disagree with that. I think every child can learn. We need to provide them the tools, and a need grant will help.
Now, Senator, I think the argument, I certainly agree with Representative Winters with what she said, but, we're hearing from these gentlemen that if we put in a hope-type scholarship, it's going to draw away from, it's going to detract from the neediest. And, we're committed not to do that. And I think there's more than one way to implement. One of the reasons why I'm thrilled about the opportunity here, and That's what I'm at this legislature for, is, you know, to find opportunity for our young people to learn. But Georgia and Nevada, of course, have emerging high-tech industries. But I tell you, you know, I keep thinking back to what Senator Deckard said. Intel, he used, I think, ESI or LSI, but they hire 80% of their engineers from outside the state because we can't produce that quality of engineer in this state. Just think what it would mean to the young people in terms in this state, in terms of quality of life, to you know, get a top quality education from any one of our seven in public institutions and the independents, and stay in this state and work and have start at $50,000 to $60,000 a year if they have a suitable degree. So I think Oregon once again is unique. And, you know, I've been around here when we've done some unique things, the beach bill, the bottle bill, land use planning and zoning. And I think there's an opportunity to do the same thing for higher ed if you would just allow us to do it and join with us to get it done. Because there are, as Representative Schrader said, there are opportunities for funding out there that we've never had before, because those opportunities are represented by people that need our young people highly educated to work for them. And at this point, why, they're all coming from outside the state. So, I mean, that's, if I had to pick one reason why I want to do this, it's, you know, to give opportunities for our young people to get the kind of education that qualifies them for the kind of jobs that are available. And boy, you put the numbers to it in terms of, you know, personal income tax and all of that, it's unbelievable what it does for state revenue. But anyway, said too much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Having not been totally immersed in this issue, it seems to me that we aren't really arguing about all the things that we would like to do. And I guess my question to you, since Senator Deckard isn't here, what discussions have occurred as to a new innovative funding source out there? It seems to me Intel could go ahead and do this if they were the primary funding source or a group of people. Has there been discussion as to a vehicle or a mechanism for getting this money together?
Yes, there has, Representative. A lot of discussion, but, you know, it's pretty sensitive, you know, like what government agencies are going to make a contribution to this, for instance, or what private companies, and you mentioned Intel, and they, you know, have exhibited a willingness, and in an earlier time, of course, they've come on more difficult times now, but there was a time when the corporate kicker kicked that if they would be willing to invest a portion of that into preparing, you know, our students, our young people for jobs at Intel out there. But, you know, don't quote me by saying they were prepared to do that now, even if there is a corporate kicker, which we're told now there's a good possibility that there will be a corporate kicker. But that's just one example. And you know, the what we get into when we raid the state accident insurance fund and those sort of things. But I can make a real case. I'm probably going to be sorry that I said this, but I can make a real case for taking some of the unemployment trust fund money, which I think is about $1.8 billion now, and actuarially they are covered for, I think, 25 months, and they all need to be for 18 months. But this is not saying that I'm going to pursue that. This is an answer to your question. Have, you know, we've been looking at all of these things, but, you know, an argument. What better way to prevent unemployment, to prepare our young people for employment, for the jobs that we know are going to be available 2, 3, 4, 5 years down the road? So, you know, that's where, you know, our thoughts are coming from, and Representative Shetterly and Senator Deckert and Senator Representative Schrader and I mean, we've talked about this a lot, but it's just not at a position where we can step up and say, you know, we're going to introduce a bill to do this, because it's new territory, you know. And it's, I go back, it's just like, you know, when the idea about statewide land use planning and zoning came about, it was just on the minds of a few people, and it took us a long time to get what turns out to be, you know, a world-class law, certainly the best in the 50 states. So in my mind, this type of scholarship is in that same category. don't know how we're going to get there exactly, but I know the cause is so good that without interfering with the opportunities and needs grants, we will get something that will provide an opportunity for our people.
If I may, Mr. Chair,
sure.
I want to just clarify one thing. The argument that we're really making about, and it really is about creating opportunities for people, mm-hmm. is sort of a two-part argument. Our concern is really that in other states where this have been done is that you end up losing your need grant money. That's what we're concerned about, because
right.
I wouldn't disagree with what Representative Winters said about giving people the tools and that being very important, because we do see that as a very important tool. But what we're concerned about is that that it needs to be done to create a way to protect and bolster that money so that both tools are available, because you can look at just a lot of areas by geography where some folks are being better prepared for any number of reasons, and I think your argument is showing the complexity of that issue, but some folks in from different parts of even the same city are just coming out better prepared for a whole lot of reasons.
Right.
And our concern would just be that that the committee look at finding a way to keep what we see as one of the very best tools still healthy, because it had come up in the last committee. There's no high achieving student that is being turned away from the need grant for being high achieving, and we obviously think that will still be the case. And I will check on the information that Representative Schrader brought up. I got a sheet from the Student Assistance Commission this morning that said, I think they had called around to the schools that said satisfactory progress at is a 2.0 at most schools. But if that is not the case, I will certainly clarify that.
Representative Schrader.
Just one last question, if I may. If we were able, some miracle, to fully fund the knee grant this plan, would you be in support of this type of legislation?
Chair Hartung, Representative Schrader, after I was finished doing my backflips, I would very likely, I would say the OSA board could probably support support a program like this. I mean, if you could fully fund.
I'm not saying anything. As Hartung said, just wanted to get it, where are we here?
Mr. Chair, I think if you could fully fund that and fully fund the other, we'd have a tremendously much better system if you could do both, no question about it. And probably the one that emphasizes merit on the long run over time would be the one that would grow faster than the knee grant would, because these students would be have the incentive to perform better.
Well,
if you get
right.
it. But right now, a lot of the people who get the need grant are people who do perform very well.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So it's not as though they're being denied.
Good. Well, John's used up a lot of your time.
I'll keep it very short. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm here just as a representative.
Yourself for the record.
Oh, my name is Rem Nivens. I'm the legislative advisor for students for the Oregon Community College Association. And I'm just here as to represent the Oregon Community College Student Association Board. And basically their position is that they are opposed to Senate Bill 100 because they would like to see the Opportunity Grant fully funded before they examine or look at supporting any other scholarship issues. So it kind of goes to what Representative Schrader was saying. If there was some miracle somewhere and that program was fully funded, then I think they'd be open to any number of programs that you might want to implement to help, students who are achieving go to college and get degrees. So I think that's just the basic fundamental focus for them, is to make sure that program is funded first. That's their first priority.
Thank you, Rem. Questions or comments for Rem? If not, any other business to come before this committee? I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 100 and adjourn.